Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Very happy to be speaking with you about Relentless. That's a perfect renamed title for this film, because this film is relentless, Tom. It is bloody, it is brutal, it is savage, it is barbaric even, with a primal ferocity that I rarely see in film. Just, wow, you blew my mind with this one.
Oh, thank you.
Where did the whole idea for Relentless arise? Because it's really interesting. We've got revenge happening structurally. You really keep us in the dark and just build up the violence and the brutality and the bloodshed until finally we start getting bits and pieces of what's going on. But we've got revenge. We think it's a simple home invasion. This is anything but a simple home invasion. We've got computer hacking involved. We've got data manipulation involved. You've got just on so many levels, you have emotional complexities in driving thematics here. So I'm curious where this all started. What made you think of this? Were you reading a cereal box at breakfast one day and come up with this?
Pretty much. Well, what happened is I had a kid. Dun, dun, dun.
Uh-oh, well, that'll do it.
And once you have a kid, you're like, oh, man, if I'm going to do another movie, there's a chance it may be my last one. So it better be one that I find the most interesting and that I love and most passionate about the most. So one thing I always loved is in a thriller, there's this cat and mouse chase.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always like 10% of the movie. And I was like, why can't that be the whole movie?
Yeah.
That's what I want to see. And since I just had a kid and I may never be able to do this again, I got it. I'm going to do a cat and mouse scene as a full movie. That was the main inspiration. And after that, I really started thinking about the world of Twitter and how the Twitter sphere works,
mm-hmm.
where it's just these people like screaming, but no one's really listening, and it's very targeted. Like, well, this person's dumb because, and I thought, well, what if that was like two characters? What if it was just they are Twitter, you know?
Okay.
Like, they're just full of revenge and rage, and they're just gonna get justice. But according to whom? According
yeah.
to what? What does it matter if they do? What does it change? And that's where I thought the layers started to come in and where I started to see the characters, this, like, blinded by one iota of truth without thinking about anything else at all possible, and how that's somewhat how Twitter works now. Was just this, it's like this scathing, you are guilty because, but no one's really listening for the rest.
Right.
And so I wanted to kind of combine those two elements, this like cat and mouse chase that I love so much, and this idea of you are guilty because I deem you so, and see what kind of happened. So that was my main framework in writing the film. And along the way, I started thinking of, like, I love action films. I was born and raised on action films. It's in my blood. There's nothing I want to do more than more action films. And I started thinking, what have I not seen in an action film? Where can, like, logically these people go? And I started thinking about these interesting set pieces and how to structure that into the story. And then once I combined all those elements, I kind of realized, like, oh, within this, there's a lot of intensity, and I have a movie here. Now I just need to peel back some layers scene by scene and start getting to know these people more. And so that's where the inspiration and how the development of it happened. And once we were there shooting, certain things got, like, extended, you know, like once we're shooting inside a car wash, an action scene inside a car wash, you're kind of like, you realize how cool it is, and you're like, I gotta make this scene longer. This has to be a brutal fight scene, you know? So that's kind of how it all played out as we, as the story kind of developed and where they're on location. So,
well,
yeah, I mean, the main motivation was just Twitter and cat and mouse chases.
Careful, you know, Elon Musk could come after you for percentages and royalties, things like that.
Well, he could. You never know.
You never know. But I'm glad you brought up what is, I think, one of my favorite scenes in the film, and that is the car wash scene. And this is exactly why all these bubble washes are shut down at night. When the sun sets, you can't get car washes through the bubble wash anymore. This is why. Thank you for explaining that to me.
Yeah.
Now I know what the issue
is. It's dangerous at night there.
I got to tell you, that scene is so well shot, Tom. You know, we're going, sitting there, listening to that song that was an earworm in my head all night long after I watched the film. Let's all go to the car wash. But it is so well shot, and the tension is so thick, because you just think, you've got the blonde bimbette sitting in the car, and she's bopping along through the car wash. We've got the soap suds, we see the rollers, and you're just thinking, something's going to happen. And you're pacing it out, which is kudos to you and your co-editor, David Pitt. You're pacing this so that we're chomping at the bit more and more. Is something going to happen? Before it does. And when it happens, man, it's better than bugs squashing on your windshield when you're speeding down the highway.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that scene it's interesting you say it was well shot, because during that scene, we actually broke a lens. And so we had to use a backup lens, and really kind of like that required a lot of trickery and cinemagic to pull off properly after that lens went down. But yes, it was like a challenge, but I think in the end, when you watch a scene now after it's been like produced up, it looks very well done, you know.
So yeah,
I'm happy with how that scene turned out.
No, it is fantastic, because you're shooting in the car, inside the car. You're also shooting outside. You edit it together beautifully, but it's those shots from inside the car that are just killer. No pun intended.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
They are fantastic.
Yeah, that was something that when I was laying out the story, I wanted to start from inside, so everything felt like, you know, you finally got away from the action and you got a little break, and it felt like we were entering something new, only to come back with something even more brutal, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you keep in, you increase the brutality, the savagery as we go, the barbarism, because ultimately by the time we get to that third act, it really is this barbarism that we are seeing Teddy really executing. Jeffrey Decker gives an amazing performance, but you really set this up beautifully from the start with the haves and the have-nots. We meet, who we learn is Teddy. We meet this guy living in his car. He's totally strung out. He definitely has mental issues. The physicality that Jeffrey puts into the character when he's sitting out on the ground smoking and fingers moving in the air like he's on a different plane, really impressive. But it's also, it draws you in and you're wondering, who the heck is this guy? We counter that with June, with this very highly, you can tell, highly successful Asian gentleman who is glued to his laptop. So you're wondering, is he in high finance? You know, it's something. Smart, well-educated, and he's got money. So you set us up with the haves and the have-nots, which was a great way to start this based on how you structure this story and play it out. And you hit us with, almost immediately, with violence, with the home invasion. And that is the first great set piece that just warms the water for what's to come. How challenging was orchestrating, because you also did your fight choreography, how challenging was orchestrating that opening home invasion sequence using the multi-levels within the house for the fight sequence?
Well, originally, the idea was to do something on one sole level. And when we got to the location, because I originally wanted something with like high ceilings that was just very, like lots of open space. But when we got to the location, we realized we had so much more to work with. So I wanted to kind of like just explore the area and add more to this like cat and mouse chase dynamic where we see them, where there's always one character on the run, one character is giving chase. And the hardest aspect was mixing kind of the in camera with post visual effects,
mm-hmm.
because we were able to bring in like a prop door, a prop table, multiple prop tables to destroy prop glass, but I didn't want to destroy anything at the actual location. So, like, we would, you know, have the character kick down the prop door, but then quickly clean it. and wipe all the dust out from everywhere and make sure everything's clean. And then have kind of, like, the characters interacting where later I would VFX the door back on the ground with all the dust. Because it was like we would just do things quick to get like one clean shot of it, and then we'd move on and try to just like save ourselves from having to take a hit on destroying the entire house, you know, which mm-hmm. costs more than my entire life. So yeah, I mean, that was the main challenge. The other challenge beyond that was just making sure that like we were able to move around the space and present the idea of chaos. So rather than the idea of like these fight scenes that are choreographed and they look like a dance, that is somewhat of a trend right now in mainstream action films that I was looking to move away from. I want dirty, up close, intense, eye gouging, fingers in the mouth, disgusting things that people who are in a life or death situation will really do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I was trying to capture as more of that like chaotic energy and that like grappling, like we don't know what we're doing style of fighting, where it's just like two people who are aggressive, not necessarily two people who are like black belts or wire fighting, you know? So to keep that entertaining while also keeping the struggle involved is where kind of the choreography would come in and where I'd step in and say, okay, now we're going to do this. We're going to move here. When I wrote that scene, I wrote it with a lot of those elements in.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes the belief is you should just write, you know, big fight happens, this character escapes. What I believe is you should write exactly what you want to shoot, but you should do it in a way where the pages keep moving and it's, you know, cozy to the eye to look at and read versus writing every actual, like, detail. But I would write, you know, character grabs him by the face, pushes him against the counter, then he falls, and then he grabs the glass to hit him over the head. You know, like, I would write all these elements out, and then we would kind of do a quick blocking of them beforehand, and what we would really be going after is making sure that, like, let's say a character's taking some sugar glass over the head, that feels okay and we know how to do that safely. But getting there, I let it feel a little messy because mm-hmm. I wanted it to feel more chaotic, you know. So that's what I was trying to capture with the choreography.
Well, you definitely gave us chaos. It's just like a street melee, but between two people. And it's just arms and feet and legs and everything is just flying everywhere. And I love how you make great use of the house, the kitchen, the living room, the stairs. And kudos to your DP, to David Pitt. I got to tell you, the camera work in these fight scenes, be it in the house, the car wash, later on in the third act, but the camera work in the house that sets the stage for us. There's great dutching. I love the shots going through the shutters on the closet door because they're not only are they dutched, but they're through the slats in the shuttering. Just some really nice, nice, engaging camera work that varies things up, much as the way Teddy and June are varying things up as they're fighting and clamoring after each other. So you really set the stage and hook people right away with this, Tom.
Well, thank you. Yeah, part of that camera work, David did a great job, but also he worked with Matt Stewart, who one of his specialties is he uses a segue rather than a dolly or a Steadicam, and he will ride the segue and go really, really fast while wearing Crocs.
Oh God!
And he will get these great zoom in and moving shots where we can keep the action kind of like, you know, we could run with characters as we go, and it really creates this like kind of kinetic energy to some of these shots that happen. And you'd never know that it's someone who's actually riding a Segway.
Wow.
Like a 12-year-old, toy for a 12-year-old. You know what I mean? It's amazing.
Because I was going to ask you, you know, obviously so much of this, it looks handheld because of the very nature of the fight choreography. So I was going to ask you, was it a Steadicam? Was it handheld? But riding the Segway, that is brilliant for the choreography that you have. For the choreography you have, that was a brilliant way to go.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it really helped in keeping that, like, kind of, it's like you still have the shake from things being held, but also you have this, like, explosive, like, in-and-out movement. You have quick, you know, quick reactions to things happening. And, yeah, I think it really helped present this idea of, like, once you get sucked in, you're moving with the camera, and there's just, it adds a lot more impact to things like punches and tackles. Mm-hmm. It really helps sell those big stunts.
Another area where you really excel is that initial, the fight within the car over the getting the laptop. That's it, like the 24-minute mark of the film. It's never easy to shoot inside the car. It's one thing to shoot with the camera in the back seat or the front seat to catch the bubble wash and the car going through the car wash. It's something completely different when you have two guys grappling over something inside the car, one coming from each side of the car. And that is so well done. So well done, Tom.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, that scene was very dependent on some post-editing techniques I did where I would like zoom in on certain shots and almost digitally add little camera moves to some shots that were shot on a tripod and still. So that one is kind of a testament to some of these like cinemagic tricks where you're adding impact to moves as they happen. Like, for example, Shuhei Kinoshita, who plays the role of June, there's this moment where Jeffrey Decker slams his head into the glove compartment. And what we did is we would shoot that slow on essentially a tripod. And then later I would go in and add these like digital little shakes and little moves where the camera would turn in left as his face would hit on the right side and kind of whip the camera back a bit digitally. So it adds this like, it's just this little extra shake that gives this impact to the move.
Yeah.
And when you combine it with like the score and the sound effects, like it really looks like, and then I would speed up the shot a little bit. And it really looks like he's like getting his head crunched, you know?
Yeah.
So,
It really does. Something that's very interesting in your structuring is that we really have no dialogue but for what the fuck do you want from me for the first about 37 minutes of the film or 30 minutes of the film. And then when we have Teddy, it's, you know what I want. I don't know. You know what I want. I don't know. So it really takes us till that 30, 37 minute mark before we finally start actually getting some coherent or cogent dialogue.
Right.
And I think it's that beautiful, that twilight sunset shot with Teddy sitting on his car outside, lighting a cigarette, listening to his cell phone message again. And then as we segue into the water bottle on the floor, because June is dying of thirst, he wants water, Teddy taunts him. And then things, we start getting some more dialogue and start getting some explanation. Somewhat. You really, really pull us along in divulging. Your breadcrumbs are spread out here, Tom, as to everything that's unfolding. How challenging was the edit on this to come up with that pace and your decisions for drawing it out so long?
Well, I think when you're a fan of action films, you don't need, you're kind of mentally trained to accept as little as possible in order to get on someone's side. Mm-hmm. And so my goal was to use that almost against your natural inclination as an audience. So I know you're on June's side when Teddy goes on the attack. I know.
Yeah.
You see him as the aggressor. But is he the aggressor? I don't know. So the idea was to give you some breadcrumbs and make sure you're following. But once you start understanding, then you go on a new journey. And that was part of the goal of the film, is how many times can I take you on a journey, but also, you know, meet, subserve that action quotient, you know, that idea of like, hey, we got to get some fistfights in here, but also, is there something deeper behind all this? And yeah, the goal was definitely to try to give you breadcrumbs and string you along on the way, but also to challenge, like, your notion of what you understand as someone who likes action films and is used to the common dynamic you see in every action film. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted to play with that structure a bit, but also I wanted to be able to hit you with, like, some explosions, right, that suck you in. And then once you're moving at a faster pace, once things slow down, you truly get to, like, keep moving along that journey, because now you've been sucked in through all this. And if we would have started the story in a different manner, where the character is already tied up in a chair and one character is talking to him about why he's in the chair, I don't know if the journey would have been like, I don't know if it would have sucked in the audience as well. And so really the goal was to try to get the audience to not understand the roller coaster they were about to go on. And then once they get to a certain point, they start realizing it, change it. Just change course.
Yeah, you get to that hour mark, to the 59-minute mark, the hour two mark, and then things just, like, explode. June goes off on this tirade, on this rant. And you're taken aback, and it's like, whoa, and you have to rethink a lot of what you've already thought up to that point. So it's really interesting structurally, the way you do that. And that, because I was thinking, my God, is he just going to just get pummeled and beaten for the whole film? And then it's like, whoa, that is not at all what's going to happen. And at that 1 hour mark, you just, it is no holds barred as to both characters for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I wanted something in that moment, you know, when the story starts to open up a bit more. I wanted something that almost felt as explosive as the action did in the beginning, but from a dramatic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, One thing that people tell me sometimes is they say, you know, this is like an action movie that turns into a play almost. And it's like, yes, that's the idea, this idea that we're going somewhere else and you're still getting these like kind of like little bubbles bursting of story that are moving in a different way, but they feel as intense. But it's just you're not seeing fist fly, you know. And so that was some of the goal of doing the story this way, was to try to get you to, you know, go on this journey that still feels intense, start with a bunch of action, and then create the same intensity without it. Mm-hmm. And see if I could kind of sustain that story and then, you know, ultimately pay it off in the end. So, yeah, I mean, that's great you recognize that.
You got some great things happening here. We've got your implementing slow motion in a couple scenes, particularly in that third act with the poor laptop computer. That poor laptop. And then you've also got sound coming into play. And the way that you'll strip away score, you'll strip away noise, but then we just hear tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. The clock is ticking on multiple levels. And there are like two different sections where you employ the tick-tock, tick-tock sound. And it's very, very effective for ratcheting up the tension, and you're wondering, what the heck is going to happen next? A countdown. So it's just fantastic the way you structure that. And then you bring in your score. What were you looking for musically from your composer, Tom?
I think the biggest goal with that specific section there was to kind of bridge the gap between every time we see action in the film, this thing happens where things get bigger and they open up and they get more explosive sounding. And there's a lot of drums and movement and like things that feel kinetic. And when we get to the scene that you're referencing now, mm-hmm. the idea was, how do I continue to build with something that's explosive that can feel like we're going to a different level? And it's kind of interesting, editing-wise, this is a great technique. Sometimes what brings you more intensity is by actually stripping those elements away. Because right now we're dealing with mental intensity instead of physical intensity.
Right.
We are seeing a few things that are physical, the character dealing with the laptop, but really we're going from the minds of June, who's now dealing with his ultimate version of suffering in this film is now happening, while at the same time the other character is revealing his ultimate form of aggression and now I'm taking out revenge on you. And so there's two mental things happening, and I wanted this idea of bridging the gap of everything we know about these characters, where they go to their special place that's been established so far.
Mm-hmm.
June has this return to center meditation he does. And Teddy has these phone calls he listens to, this voicemail that reminds him why he's doing this. And I wanted to bridge the gap there. And so the best way to do that, since we're focused on this mental intensity, was to start stripping away all the layers and just add a hint. It's almost like this is a very loud moment. What's the best way to get you to pay attention to the loudness the most? Well, to turn everything down.
Yeah.
And it was this great kind of pull the rug out from under you moment that I think a lot of the editing there really sells. And I'm really proud of how that came out. Because one thing you'll notice in that scene is we go from one character's kind of sounds and tones to the next. And then we kind of, like you said, it works as a countdown to what's about to come, and then we get very explosive again.
Yes. Very much so. Very much so. Some of the techniques that you use for the brutality and the violence, barbed wire, absolutely fantastic. I cringe the entire scene. anybody that has never felt barbed wire on their skin to see it being wrapped around somebody's hand and arm, you will cringe because it is painfully horrific. And it's very effective. Very effective. It becomes sensory when you watch it, Tom, as do so many of the things here. David, again, camera work, fantastic. June is trying to get to a bottle of water on the floor, and the camera is actually flat down on the floor to shoot that. A lot of really wonderful camera angles that counter a lot of the violence. Some embrace it. Just on every level. So well done, Tom. I mean, this just... And by the time the film ends, it's like, oh my God. This really is not over. Because of the themes that you have and the way you've structured it, is this is a never-ending battle. Like on Twitter. It does not end. But I do have to ask, how did you come up with the idea to have poor June running from his house, doesn't bring his laptop, but he brings a pair of sneakers, and in the middle of an intersection, changes his shoes and puts his sneakers on? I was laughing my ass off.
So that's something that Shuhei added to that particular scene, because as a Japanese-American, that was one of the things he kept telling me about the character, is this, you know, when you, in a Japanese household, what you do is you take off, you have your indoor shoes, you have your outdoor shoes, you know, and it's kind of like this reverting to panic. He doesn't know what to grab, so he grabs his outdoor shoes. It was like this idea of like fleeing, like you're a chicken with its head cut off.
Mm-hmm.
You grab the first thing you know from your everyday habit, right? When you go outside, you grab your outdoor shoes. And so, yeah, it was like, I thought it was a really nice touch, this idea that he's now running through the streets and he's like, oh my God, I have my slippers on. Let me get my outdoor shoes on. And, you know, it was just a nice touch to add that I think really kind of solidified who he is as this person who he thinks, but he doesn't, like, he thinks things through, but also he's always at a level of panic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to try to return to center. And the ideas he lands on in a moment of panic aren't necessarily the most helpful, but they're like this, something that captures his outer shell as a being, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah, and it was also, you know, a moment of levity there of like, what's this guy doing?
You know? It was, you know, it was great. And of course, you shot it right there in the intersection, in the neighborhood intersection, where you had street light, shining light down, so he could see, he could make sure he got the correct shoe on the correct foot. I mean, it was great. After the intensity of the home invasion, to have that moment of levity, because we only get one or two more lighter moments that still have darkness in them, though, for the rest of the film. You keep this high octane from beginning to end, Tom. And for this film, it works incredibly well. And it leads me to my last question for you. I'm curious. Hopefully you'll get to make more films, even though there is a child in the mix of your life now. So assuming that you will make more films, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker in making Relentless that you can now take forward into future projects?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the biggest things I learned is that the audience doesn't need as much as I think they do to either relate to a character or get on a character's side. I think originally the first cut of this film had multiple other scenes where we're getting to see Teddy as this homeless character. And at a certain point, I have like three or four scenes of him, you know, showing that he is homeless. And ultimately, when I started to peel things back in the edit, I realized all you really need to do is see him eating in the car. Like, we know. You need to see him looking, you know, out of the window and pulling that curtain shut for his car because it's time to go to bed. Like, there's so much the audience already understands. And I think a lot of time there's this tendency to teach writers, like, beat him over the head with, like, I don't understand. I need to know that he's eating an apple, and therefore that is why he's hungry. Like, there's so much, like, I don't know the best way to put it, but there's like, too much of an emphasis on pretending the world is dumb, mm-hmm. and they're not going to understand unless they see you force-feeding them something. And what I learned in this film is, I think it'd be more interesting if you just saw him do this, and then we know his plight. And ultimately what I realize is that's probably more accurate of how an audience would react to something. And it's much more beneficial to take in your story as you're writing it from an audience's perspective versus a writer's perspective. I think a lot of people get sucked into, like, I got to write it this way because as a writer, that's the best way. And it's not. The writer doesn't matter when I'm sitting and watching a movie in a theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're sitting in your living room and watching it on the couch. You are the person who matters the most. The most important ingredient is the crowd, the audience.
Yeah.
And so you really have to look at things through their eyes and how they would take it. And I think writers are taught to look at it through a writer's eyes, which is wrong. You're writing it for the audience. So... that's probably the biggest lesson I learned. The other lesson is shoelaces, spray painted silver, look like barbed wire. So I will take that with me for every film I do from now on.
I like that. I like that, Tom. Oh my God. Tom, I can't thank you enough. This has been so great getting to speak with you about Relentless. And...
thank you for having me.
Find time, even with a child, find time to make another film, please.
I will do my best.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.